everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. It's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing, writing life, and video interviews with all kinds of interesting authors. In fact, our new issue is up, and it's got my conversation with Amit Goswami on it. Amit is Dr. Amit Goswami. He's a quantum physicist and author and fascinating guy. And you wouldn't think quantum physicists had a lot to say about writing, but they do. At least he did. And life in general, I highly recommend you check it out at authormagazine.org. And we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. As you know, PNWA hosts a writers' conference every summer here in the Seattle area, down in SeaTac. And this year, you know, one of the things they're doing that's pretty good is, you know, it's a conference for all writers of all kinds, poetry, nonfiction, memoir, romance, history, literature, you name it. And they've kind of broken up all the classes into tracks. So there's the romance track, there's the memoir nonfiction track where you'll find me, there's the poetry track, there's the thriller track. So it makes it easier for people who are new to conferences to find the classes that are right for them. It's a great conference. I'll be teaching a fearless writing half-day masterclass on the 20th. So it goes from the 20th to the 23rd of July, the 20th to the 23rd of July. I'll be teaching a masterclass in fearless writing on the Thursday. Donald Moss is coming for his Writing the Breakout book. Chris Vogler is going to be there doing his Hero's Journey thing. Bob Degoni, Cece Humphreys, all kinds of great teachers, agents, editors, you name it. It's a great conference. If you've never been to a conference, I highly recommend you check it out. Conferences are great places to meet other writers and to put a human face on the publishing world, which is often just names on websites or on dust jackets. So check it out at pnwa.org. Speaking of fearless writing, my new book out, Fearless Writing, How to Create Boldly and Write with Confidence. It's out from Writer's Digest Books. You can get it anywhere, but I will be this Thursday, so that would be June 22nd, I will be down at, where will I be? I will be at with the Skagit Valley Writers in Burlington, Washington, giving a free, I think it's free, two-hour fearless writing lecture, workshop. So if you're in that area, go down and check it out. Go down and check it out. Well, I'm so glad I got today's guest on the show, Claire Dieterer. If you like memoir, which I do, boys and girls, I do. If you like memoir, you're probably already a fan of Claire. She is the author of the critically acclaimed New York Times bestseller Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses, which was translated into 11 languages, optioned for television by Warner Brothers, and adapted for the stage. Claire is also a longtime contributor to the New York Times, and her essays, criticisms, and reviews have appeared in The Atlantic, Harper's, The Nation, Vogue, Chicago Tribune, Real Simple, Entertainment Weekly, New York Magazine, Yoga Journal, Newsday, Slate Salon, and many others. Oh, my God, but she's also got a new book out, and ooh, it's a good one, a new memoir, Love and Trouble, A Midlife Reckoning. Ooh, we're going to talk about that and then some more. Hello, Claire. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill. Thank you for having me. Are we going to talk about physics? There's not going to be any physics, right?
Well, I don't think it would be a very long conversation because I don't know much about it. Maybe you do. So. You're a smart gal. Maybe you picked up a few things. I don't know much.
I think I just said everything I have to say about physics.
Well, you got a lot to say about writing, though, I'm sure. I don't know if you remember this, but you and I was thinking of this when I was reading Love and Trouble. You and I were on a panel at the Chuckanut Writers Conference. It was just you and me, actually. We were the only two people on there. And it was called, I think it was called Writing the Difficult Thing, appropriately enough. And so you started talking about your next book, which you were formulating at that time. And I don't remember what you said exactly, but you said, I want to write about, It was like you were having a confession. You said, I want to write about my teenage years and sex. That's what I want to write about. I want to write about sex. And I heard this, and so I immediately did the thing where I said, oh, I know what this book's going to be like, and I took my teenage years but made me female and figured that's what the book would be because that's what I do. That was not the case, as it turns out. It's a very different kind of book than my life. But how would you describe it to folks when you give your little summation of it?
Well, it's interesting that you came at it from this point of view of me saying I wanted to write sort of a coming-of-age book about sex and the teenage years, because that was the idea. I've been working on this book, or I worked on it for 5 or 6 years. And for at least 2 or 3 of the years I worked on it, the idea was that I was going to write a book about coming of age in the 70s and 80s and what that was like as a sexually promiscuous girl. And I worked and worked on it, and it was sort of inert, but I kept working on it because I did really have a lot to say about growing up in that culture. But after a couple of years, I had to confess to myself, like, I don't like coming-of-age books. No offense to anyone out there who's writing one, but as a reader, they're just not something I really enjoy. So I sort of started interrogating myself, why am I writing this book about coming-of-age when I don't like coming-of-age books? What's going on here? And I realized, I think I was 44 or 43 when I started the book, I realized that one of the reasons I was writing about my younger self, a self which was troubled and melancholy and hypersexual, was that I was having all those same feelings again at midlife.
Right.
That was what was motivating me to look at this time in my life. And once I sort of acknowledged that the reason I was so fascinated by this younger self was that she had sort of come roaring back, whether I wanted her or not, the book took on a new dynamism because it was really about the past and the present and how they related, which is deeply interesting to me.
Yeah, yeah. What is it? Faulkner said, the past isn't dead, it's not even past, I think was his.
That's very much the... theme of this, the motto of this book.
It is. And
so the book sort of, that's how the shape of it works. It toggles between those two time periods. And that, in turn, presented a whole new set of writing issues because really the book deals with the idea of the lack of change. You are who you were.
Right.
You don't get better. And in many ways, it's a memoir of failure. We don't transform. We don't ascend. We're the person we were. Which is, I think, authentic, but very difficult to organize a plot around.
It is, because plots are generally shaped around change.
Mm-hmm.
That
very
is
true.
Kind of the fundamental. In fact, my wife is doing a thing with my son. We do some homeschooling for him around using Pixar's storytelling. They have a great online storytelling, free online storytelling series of videos. And it
really?
Is absolutely structured around, and they're great, you know, but it's a Pixar story, but it's beautifully done and it's free. And they have all their people teaching you how to tell stories in that sort of classic sense. And it's absolutely based around change. I mean, that's fundamental
to
the story.
Well, Disney, I think when I first started to really take apart plot when I was working on my first book, I actually did it because I met a woman who'd been a development girl, which is their term, not mine, at Disney. I met her at the Hedgebrook Writers Retreat, and we were all sitting around the table. I was working on my book, Poser, and it was a lot of poets and me and this novelist who used to be a development girl at Disney. And she mentioned the Disney three-act structure. And all of the poets sort of got up and left the table, like sort of, I don't know if it was in protest, but they were definitely not interested. And I was on deadline. I had sold my book and proposal, and I had to figure out how to turn my life into a story.
And
I was just like, I just like pulled my chair closer and said, tell me everything. And she talked to me about the Disney three-act structure. And now that I'm a much more experienced storyteller and teacher, I know that it's the exact same structure as Aristotle. I mean, it's all these truisms about how stories are told. They're very old, and they're very sturdy. And that's how I wrote Poser, was on a very sturdy three-act structure. Poser, my first book. But this book couldn't rely on that structure, which was exciting and scary.
Yeah. Well, and I understood one of the challenges that you were facing. You know, so it's tricky. I read these things as someone who writes and who writes about his own life to, as I've said before, the exclusion of anything else at this point. And so I'm aware of the challenges that come up. And what I saw immediately as you were writing it, that you had what I can imagine are two very real challenges, which is when one writes about the deep past, you know, the 20-year past, the 80s and the 70s, you have a different perspective to it than some of the stuff you were writing about, which was happening almost contemporaneously to when you were writing about it, it seemed. It was, or much closer
Correct.
To it. And that has, and you have a different relationship to that memory than you do to the 20-year-old memory. It just something
That's
happens over time.
Interesting. I never thought of it quite that way. Yeah.
At least I do. It becomes more fictional in a way. It becomes closer to fiction.
Which does,
than
the contemporary or the adult?
The older stuff, because your mind, you're working so much with imagination, whereas the thing that just happened, it's fresh and hot out of the oven, you know, of experience.
So it's also true that what we're living through, we're telling complicated stories to ourselves about and lies.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, most definitely.
But, yeah, that reconstruction of the past is really an imaginative act, and I experienced that a lot in this book just because, honestly, in a really simple way, because I did so much writing about the past. You know, Poser, my first book, has very little flashback. It seems like a lot of the book, but it's only 8,000 or 10,000 words. But once you start trying to write great tracks about your past, you get immediately to the problem of reconstruction, which I think is endlessly fascinating.
You like it.
So
you're interested just in that challenge.
Yeah, I like it. I like the problem of building it and wondering how truly it's staying nonfiction. You know, I think that's really interesting. I assert that this is a nonfictional book, and I believe in it as a nonfictional book, but I know that some of it is constructed from memory, unreliable memory.
You have to.
So that's a truer way to say it, is it's a book made out of memory.
You know, I have to thank you for something. I hadn't thought. I actually sat in on one of the classes you taught at Chuckanut, and you were actually giving a class on language. But the thing that stuck out to me was your focus on scene in memoir, the power of scene. And I did it naturally, but I'd never thought about it. And I teach a lot of memoir now, and and when I get my students to go into scene, something changes in their experience of their past, because they want to write about it in general often, instead of getting into a scene.
Yes, the general past tense, the enemy of good writing.
Yes, it is. It is. You have to get specific, even if it means constructing a scene, cobbling memories together to construct you walking home from school instead of talking in general about walking home from school, for instance.
Right. We always walked home from school. We would take the overpass to the play field.
Right.
That's not interesting. What's interesting is I pulled my backpack onto my back and pushed through the doors of the elementary school.
That's right.
You know, it's
when
you go into the specific moment. And I taught for a long time before I really realized that a lot of writers and readers – you know, haven't really taken apart what scene means. What is a scene? And it has a lot of qualities that have to do with setting and dialogue and detail, but what it really comes down to is a specific moment in time. And as a writer, returning yourself to that specificity over and over really is the task, I think, as a memoir writer. If you really want to create this narrative that the reader can get lost in. And the mysterious thing about it is that it's just not very fun to do as a writer.
What?
It can take you deeply into memory, but I find in general that students are really resistant to it because it requires a lot of work of the writer.
Yeah.
It's really
work to
quite
remember
a bit of
the
work.
Details or to
remember the details and then make yourself set them down, and then you have to convince yourself that they're not boring. Because the minute you start to lay out the details at the level you need to create scene, it starts to feel like, oh, my God, who cares? Which is really the essential question of memoir. Who cares about what I'm saying? So you have this weird tension happening that the more details you set down, the more the reader becomes immersed in the story and has a more novelistic kind of dreamlike experience, but you worry you're boring them. Do you know what I mean?
Sure. But the fact is, it's the details, and it's allowing them to get lost in that novel. I always say to my memoir students who are new to it, you're essentially, it should read like a novel in the first, more or less. If unless it's some hybrid thing where you're doing, I do personal essay where I tend to talk a little bit and do story and back and forth. But in a true memoir, a pure memoir, which I would say this book is, you really want it to read as much like a novel, feel as much like a novel as possible.
That was something I was playing with in this book too. Is there's Poser is definitely written at much more in a novelistic voice that wants to guide the reader into my experience of this particular era of my life, the year 2000 to 2010 in North Seattle. This book is moving around and thinking and using formal play and sort of bumping you out of that novelistic experience a lot. So finding that,
but I would argue, Claire, that it's true in that you do a lot of stuff with form, but it's almost like postmoderny in a way, if I want to get academic, in that the form is part of what to me made it feel close to an experimental novel.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Anyway, our listeners may not have read the book yet, but Claire takes a lot of stylistic chances, does a lot of playing around to try to keep it interesting in a way, I think, for the readers. And I felt it worked anyway. This reader felt it worked.
Thank you. I did a lot of this formal play, and I'll just talk a little bit about it since people might not have read it. I had been writing, as I said, about my adolescence and then about my midlife, and there was a way in which the writing was, like, kind of inert. Like, it was good writing, but it was kind of sad, and it didn't have a lot of the humor that's usually in my writing. And because I was writing about, sexuality, but I was also writing about molestation and difficult sexual subjects and subjects that could be really sad. And and I was writing about them with as much detail and scene as I could. And the book was making sense, but it wasn't sort of working in the sense that I think that humor is the kind of highest intelligence, and I wasn't finding any humor in it. You know, I wasn't finding any way to have it come alive. And so at the same time that I was sort of writing this very earnest book, I was also sneaking off and sort of having an affair with these different forms. So I was writing like an ABC of college, and I wrote an open letter to Roman Polanski, and I wrote a case study of my former self where I was the scientist and I was looking at my slutty younger self and sort of trying to figure her out. And I was doing these things just to sort of entertain myself. And my best friend, who's a big character in the book and who is an artist, said to me, hey, and I was sort of tormented over the book and how it wasn't working. She said, you know, you already wrote the book. It's all these other things you're doing, these sort of one-offs that you're doing and setting aside. They are the book. And then she said, you should think about Visit from the Goon Squad. And I said, what?
Oh, yeah.
And she said, yeah, go look at Visit from the Goon Squad, which is the novel by Jennifer Egan, where each chapter has a different form and a different voice. Sometimes it's in first person, sometimes it's in second person, so forth. One chapter is written as a PowerPoint presentation. And she said, Visit from the Goon Squad. And I was like, what? You know, you're stupid artists. You know, writers can't just sort of... I was just like, I can't steal her form, and that's a fictional form. It's not a memoir form. And, you know, you don't know anything. And she just kept repeating, Visit from the Goon Squad, Visit from the Goon Squad. And I went and looked at it. And you know, artists are really good at looking at what you have and trying to make something out of it. That's something I think visual artists are very good at.
Oh, interesting.
And I went and I looked at it, and... In fact, I had already sort of made my own, you know, obviously nothing, I wouldn't compare myself to Jennifer Egan, but I had made my own multi-form Visit from the Goon Squad memoir, and the book was basically done. And I hadn't seen it. And then it was a matter of just sort of flowing a lot of the scene writing I'd already done into these different forms. And then the happy ending to the story is that I sold the book to the editor, A Visit from the Goonstone. So,
oh, really?
That was a nice thing. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
and
fascinating.
It was fascinating. And when she called me to talk to me about the proposal, when it was at auction, she said, your book reminds me of Visit from the Goon Squad, which I hadn't mentioned in the proposal. And so it was obviously a meeting of minds and hearts. So that was sort
awesome.
Of how I came around to the form. But there were all these, this is really a true, I don't know, like there were all these benefits to writing in this multivalent form that were unexpected, that had to do with the fragmentation of the self and of sexuality and all these themes in the book that sort of get expressed through the formal play.
Yeah.
So that was an unexpected result, but that's so much of writing, is sort of these happy accidents that then amplify the theme of a book, I think.
I agree. The imagination, the sort of the subconscious and the imagination often do work that all our planning mind can't possibly achieve, I think. That's been true for me at least.
Has it?
The stuff... Oh, absolutely. That if I can just get out of the way, something will happen that I didn't plan but is better than what I planned. And, oh, there it is, you know. I felt one of the advantages of some of the experimentation you did is you were able to cover a lot of ground in a short amount of space, which I think is often a challenge if you're covering tons of years. I thought it was great. I thought it was a good economical choice, too, and kept it bouncing along. I quite like. As I said before, we were talking before we started the show. I do think it will open people's eyes to what memoir can be, because I think memoir is an evolving genre, in my opinion, and I think it's a work of art, you know, ultimately. And it's easy to turn it into just a plodding remembering of the past, but I think successful memoirs is really a work of art more than anything else. And I feel like this book kind of reveals that to be the case. That was my experience of it.
Thank you. The book was really inspired by, I do feel like there's a moment that's happening more generally in nonfiction that's largely led by women. And obviously, like, Maggie Nelson or Eileen Miles are the people who are sort of out at the front of it. And I was looking more at general nonfiction than memoir when I was writing it. And I was sort of thinking about, well, how can I sort of import some of this hybridization that's going on in nonfiction into memoir, to use this formal play, to use these collage forms, to use this sort of movement between a distant voice and a close voice, an academic voice and a very, very non-academic voice. How can that be employed in memoir? There's definitely a thing happening out there right now with nonfiction that is very experimental and that is finding an audience and a critical audience as well. It's really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. See, you're right a part of it. You're right a part of it, Claire.
I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. You've always kind of been in the where things are happening. It's the kind of person you are, I think. So let me ask you something. So this book, it's out, and you've been going around talking to people about it, I assume. I saw you were down at Powell's, and you've been so. So I mean, this is obviously a challenging thing to talk about. You really lay it all out there. How has that been? How has that been? Because you know, like I said, we met talking about the difficult thing. You couldn't have really found anything more difficult in a way, maybe, to talk about. But you did, quite honestly. And so how's been? It's one thing to do it alone in your room, you know, and it's another thing to go out publicly with it. How's that been?
Well, let me ask you, what do you think is so difficult about it? Which aspect
of
it?
Well, because you have
to,
maybe I'm just a prude. Just be, you're so open about all your sexual adventures, including your relationship with your husband and some of the things you did while you were married to him. It is you don't hold back any of your warts, so to speak, and or any of your where you've struggled, and I would think that could be challenging to talk about with perfect strangers, but that might be me. I'm a little shyer, maybe. So how is that?
No,
so it
no,
hasn't
no,
been
no.
A challenge
I was just
for you.
Curious what you meant. It perfect strangers are fine. And here is something that I think a lot of memoirists find. Talking about things, it's like talking to the bartender about your problems. People tell the bartender their problems because he's a perfect stranger.
Right.
Sharing your material, in this case, very sexual material, material that's dealing with the relationship between victimization and certain sexual proclivities. And it also deals with my married sex life and desires I've had outside my marriage, all that stuff. I have no problem sharing that with a total stranger. And discussing that even when I'm on tour with a total stranger. The problem is not strangers. The problem is acquaintances. You know,
yeah.
It's the people
yeah, no.
in your life
yeah.
who aren't intimately associated with you and aren't strangers but are somewhere in that band between. What are they going to think? The moms at school, your neighbors, the friends of friends,
right.
your second cousins. That's always been true even when I was writing non-sexual memoir. Those are the people
yeah.
who I think for me are the hardest to face, and for, you know, many students, many first-time memoirists, those are the people that sort of inhibit them from doing their work, which is really what
right.
we need to be thinking about. Who is it who's inhibiting us from saying what we need to say? And I will just say that I live in a really small community. I live in a small town. It's very liberal, but it's also, you know, a bedroom community, slightly rural.
Yeah.
You know, most of the people I know through kids. And I was really nervous to put this book out in my community. And I was scared, and I was scared about what it would be like for me, for my husband, for my kids. And I have been met with nothing but warmth. I'm
great.
Sure that people, there's some nastiness behind my back, and that's fine. That just keeps
wow.
life interesting in a small town.
Uh-huh.
But in
uh-huh.
general, the project of the book is to say what is hard so that the reader feels less alone in her difficult feelings. That's the
right.
job of memoir. It's not doing its job if it just says the easy thing. I say
right.
the hard thing so that you can read it or she can read it and go, oh, I recognize myself and I'm not a weirdo and I'm not alone.
Right.
And the response
right.
I've gotten from my community has been that. Thank you for saying
yeah.
these things. It's been really, I'm actually getting kind of choked up talking to you about it. It's been
yeah.
really
it's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
A surprisingly wonderful experience.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. You know, if I go and talk about myself, I'll tell stories about myself, but invariably after I'm done supposedly talking about myself, or I use my stories as a vehicle for whatever if I'm giving a talk or whatever, people immediately want to come up and tell me their own stories. If they've been inspired
exactly.
and moved by it, it's their own stories they want to tell me. And I realized for myself, I guess this is what you were saying, but that when people read my work, I know they're reading about themselves ultimately. They're not reading about
exactly.
me.
And but that only happens if you tell stories that have, I think it really only happens if you tell stories that have some degree of difficulty. You know, I think that memoir has this reputation of being narcissistic. And I do
right.
think memoir can be narcissistic. We've all encountered memoirs like that where there's some kind of self aggrandizing going on, or there's
right.
the writer isn't really onto him or herself and aware
right.
of his own motivations and his own troubles. But when a writer knows him or herself and is laying bare those difficulties, then it's sort of the opposite of narcissistic. It's generous in the sense of
yeah.
it's kind of opening this place and saying, come in here with me. It's hard. We're all here together. We're all getting through it. I mean, it's a pushback.
Yeah, you know what the question, the first time I ever tried to write anything memoirish, and it was very helpful. I sat down to do it. I was writing these essays, but they weren't stories. But then I wanted to write a story about myself included in these essays I would write. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I'm going to write this story, but for a total stranger. And every time I tell stories about my own life, I always tell it to people who know me even just a little bit. And that creates a different relationship to storyteller and audience, I think. But I, as I sat down to write that story, I thought, why would someone who will never know me care about this? And it immediately
really
changed my relationship to the story because it had to be about something universal at that point, something bigger
than
me.
It has to be vital, and then it also has to be told better because you have to keep that person's
yes.
interest,
which
right. is that leap right. that we all, when you're dealing with memoir, you constantly face. Like, what is it that makes this writing not a journal? not for the self.
That's right.
Not a letter. What is it that makes it, you know, something bigger?
And for everyone.
The audience is, you know, with memoir, the audience is so important because it's transformative of the writing. You know, if you're thinking about the audience, then you're making story, you're turning it into art, and you're thinking less about the self.
That's right. It can't be about you. It's not about – actually, I tell my students, this isn't about you. No one cares about you. But they do care about what you can share with them in the story, but they actually don't care about you in truth.
I say that. That's exactly – that's the most important sentence you can say. Like, no one cares. You have to make them care. You have to give them a reason to care. And
yeah.
I mean, that's true with any writing, but with memoir, it's important to remember.
Well, it's not an autobiography. In other words, I will tell my students, like, they're not – if they knew who you were, they'd pick up your book to find out about you. If I read John Cleese's autobiography because I like John Cleese, and I'm reading Al Franken's new book because I like Al Franken. But even though I know you, I didn't read that because you're a celebrity. I read it because I wanted the story. And no one reads a memoirist as they would an autobiography. They read it for the story, I think.
I think that distinction is meaningful over and over. I didn't even understand it when I was working on my first memoir. And when I first realized it, it was so useful to me. You know, this idea, it has to do with your constraints and your story and your subject matter. And autobiography tells everything, but memoir just chooses a little.
That's right. That's right. Oh, Claire, I could talk to you a long time about memoir, but we've already gone over our time a little bit. So I have just one more question for you. Just one more.
Okay.
You probably answered this for me already, but I'll bet you the answer has changed anyway, because it always does. So, finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
Oh, my God.
What's it taught you, Claire?
I'm tapping my fingers. Because writing, it's just sort of what I do and have done since I was a little kid. There's no choosing it. It's just I don't judge it in that way. It's something that brings something into my life. It's just part of my life, part of my thinking. But I would say it's taught me about – the thing it's taught me in the last few years is about ambition, that especially – I hate to become gendered, but especially for women, ambition is a great thing. And to try to make your work better, try to make it bigger, try to make it smarter, and to stand up and own that is very hard, I think, for a lot of women. And this book asked that of me. I stopped being self-deprecating. I stopped pretending, my work's no big deal. The book is really trying to do a lot. And I think that was good for me, good for my daughter to see, good maybe for my son. That's what this most recent book taught me about.
That's awesome. Well, you know what that makes me wonder about is what your next book is going to be. Now that you've given yourself permission to be a big deal, I wonder what the next – but don't tell me.
I didn't mean I'm going to be a big deal. I just meant that the work will try to do a lot.
No, hey, you know what? You know what? Bullshit. I say – you absolutely should be as big a deal as you want to be, because you didn't write this book just because you had nothing better to do. You wrote this book because you thought it was awesome.
Okay, that's the point I was just trying to make. Look how I go to that comfortable place of self-deprecation immediately.
That's right. You go be awesome.
Okay, thanks.
I say it to all my students, and you're not my student, but I say you loved it, you wrote it, and you own that. Absolutely. Claire, you're a lot of fun to talk to.
You too, Bill, and I'll see you around. Thank you so much for having
me. Yeah, well, I've no doubt about it. The book is Love and Trouble. Now, do you still have some appearance dates left on your calendar?
Oh, gosh, I don't have any dates to hand. You can go to my website, ClaireDieter.com.
Okay, but it's on your website?
And I have mostly local events near Seattle.
Okay.
So I've got Lake Forest Park, and I'm in Bellingham on Thursday, and then several Seattle events in July.
Great. So, but it's is it ClaireDieter.com?
It is, exactly.
Okay, so go check it out, people. She's a lot of fun to listen to. If you're in the area, go check it out. You won't regret it. Claire, good luck, and I can't wait to read the next one.
Thank you so much. You too. Okay.
All right, take it easy.
You too. Bye-bye.
Yes. People, be ambitious. Be ambitious as you want to be. Claire's absolutely right. I will be back next week. I believe I'm doing one more before the 4th. Yes, I'll be talking to I'll be talking to Michael Berger, comedian and keynote speaker. In the meantime, go write the best, most awesome story you can possibly imagine.